Welcome to This Week in Money. I'm Jim Goddard. Today, Ross Clark from chartsandmarkets.com runs down the major markets. The hottest stock, NVIDIA, has lost a bit of its charm, but will it hold up over at least the short term? Ross also looks at the U.S. and Canadian dollars, gold, silver, and crude. Veteran BC trader Victor Adair comments on what happens to the stock market when the bosses are on holiday, the weakness in the Chinese economy, and what the U.S. government might do to pick up the economy going into an election year. Author of The Money Bubble and other books on the economy, John Rubino, gives us his take on the growing worldwide war against the U.S. dollar, increasing consumer debt, and the impact AI is having on financial affairs and the prospects for junior miners. We'll talk to Ross Clark right after this.
Recyclico, making lithium ion last forever. Recyclico's patented recycling process achieves up to 100% recovery of battery metals from lithium ion batteries for electric vehicles, including cobalt, lithium, nickel, manganese, and aluminum. Recyclico Battery Materials Incorporated trades on the TSX Venture AMY, on the OTCQB AMYZF, and Frankfurt ID4. For more information, visit recyclico.com or phone us at 778-574-4444. Recyclico, making lithium ion last forever.
Welcome to This Week in Money, the source for market opinions. Here is Jim Goddard.
My guest is Ross Clark from chartsandmarkets.com, where you'll find insightful market commentary and timely technical analysis. You can find him on Twitter at ChartsByRoss. Welcome back to the show.
Good to be with you, Jim.
What kind of week did we have on the stock markets?
Well, let's see. I guess the poster child, NVIDIA, decided that they were going to come out with some blockbuster earnings, and guess what? AI gets its time in the sun again, but it doesn't last for too long. The, all-time highs for NVIDIA becomes one of the, biggest capitalized stocks out there, but takes a little bit of a breather. This has been one big run, $120 to $480, and, that's in less than a year. And these things, they all go in cycles, and most of that AI complex and the EVs that are topped out in July, you had a few of them, like NVIDIA, that have just had a little bit more life left in them. But the momentum seems to, at this point, subsided. Trends are still up, but the momentum seems to be gone. And if we look at some measurements, I like to compare the dot-coms of the 1990s into 2000 with what we're seeing right in here. And for all that, most of those dot-coms didn't end up making any money in the long run. Companies like AMD had great moves. And we look at the percentage run here on NVIDIA and compare that with AMD, and the base that we've come out of this last year, as you measure it up, it's very similar to what AMD did back then. We are probably, two-thirds of the way through this run, and as long as it doesn't really roll over in here, there's a chance for this thing to do considerably better. And, when you own market share like these guys do, everybody's going to be after you, but it's going to be a hard one to catch up to. The general markets, if we take a look at the indices, like the Dow, the S&P, and the NASDAQ, they all, in this last week and a half, corrected back very nicely into the 20-week moving averages, which, we've been looking at various support levels. That was going to be one of the optimum ones. Got into there a week ago. Had a really nice bounce on the broad indices, recovered about a third of the losses, and then on Friday came back down, retested the lows, and as we know, Chairman Powell here is still sort of sitting on the edge. What are they going to do with interest rates? The fact is that, what will happen will happen, and we just want to watch the chicken scratches on the charts and see what they tell us. So for now, Seasonals would suggest that we should be looking at some type of a low within the next, let's call it 4 to 6 weeks here. And if we just have a pause, it could be a decent run into the end of the year. And if we take out these support levels, there are some numbers that we've got underneath here that we've got in mind, and we'll just see how they manage to hold up as we get through the Labor Day stretch.
What's going on with crude?
The bias here in crude has been, you know, to the upside after this one-year bear market. The momentum has not been terribly good, has just had this pause around the $80 level. You know, we get up to 84, pulled back into the 70s, and now we're sitting at 80. Trend is up, and I think it still has got some decent potential as we move into September. There's nothing here to say that there's any problems. If we take a look at the stocks themselves, you take a look at the XLE, the XEG, the ETFs there, they're doing, if anything, better than the oil market is doing. So there's a nice positive bias in there. The Canadian ones are doing exceptionally well. U.S. side, stocks like Exxon is just still flirting around the old highs. And if it can manage to take out some of this resistance, I think there's still some pretty good potential there.
Anything going on with gold and silver?
Silver had a pretty good week this week. Managed to have a decent run. And, you know, we're sitting now above $24. You know, this was a 23, under 23 not too long ago. Just biding its time. And, you know, the work we've got here would suggest that this consolidation, which, you know, really has been lasting a couple of years now, is getting a little long in the tooth, and I think we should be looking for a pretty good breakout as we move into September, October.
The U.S. and Canadian dollars, any hot action there?
This U.S. dollar, just, you know, with anything, doing so well, up through now 104 on the index. This was, you know, below par, below 100 not too long ago. And when you've got a market that everybody dislikes, this is just climbing a really good wall of worry right now. And as far as I can see, there's some potential for some cycle highs in here, maybe a small correction in September. That would allow also the precious metals to have a little bit of a pop. But I think, you know, you look at this 102.5 area is a potential support area on a pullback of the dollar index. And the Canadian dollar, moving with all these other currencies, if anything, it's been weaker than most. And that inability to hold well when it popped out through 75 in the spring, that really was a false start in here. And this 73.5 support area that we're at right now, I think it's going to have some difficulty holding in here.
Ross, thank you so much for the update.
Always a pleasure, Jim.
My guest has been Ross Clark from chartsandmarkets.com. Find him on Twitter at chartsbyross. Coming up, Victor Adair next on This Week in Money.
Always consult your investment professional before making any investment decision. Don't miss out. Stay informed. Receive the HowStreet.com weekly recap with thought-provoking podcasts, radio, and articles delivered to your inbox. Sign up for the HowStreet.com weekly recap on our homepage at HowStreet.com. This Week in Money is archived online at TalkDigitalNetwork.com.
Welcome back. We're speaking with Victor Adair, who recently retired from nearly 50 years of being in the brokerage business in British Columbia, but is still very, very active in the markets. He's speaking to us from Parksville on Vancouver Island. Welcome back to This Week in Money.
Jim, it's always a pleasure to talk with you. Thank you.
And remember to check out his website, victoradair.ca. Victor, in the trading desk notes you posted last week on that website, you said that the last 2 weeks before Labor Day are historically a time when the adults have left the building. Oh, boy. Can you tell us what you mean by that, especially concerning the two significant scheduled events this week, the NVIDIA quarterly report on Wednesday afternoon and Powell's speech at the annual Central Bank Leaders Conference at Jackson Hole on Friday?
Well, it's kind of self-explanatory. The last 2 weeks of the summer, you know, before we have the Labor Day and then everybody goes back to work after Labor Day, as it were, a lot of the senior people in the trading rooms are on vacation. So we call those the adults, and, you know, the guys who get the short straw or the people that have been there the least amount of time get to stay and man the desks. So what kind of historically happens is that we have, say, thin trading. Clearly, you know, there's not that many people around, and it can get choppy. And if there's some event, scheduled or otherwise, that comes along, it can create some, call it chaotic or choppy kind of price action. So on those two events, I mean, the NVIDIA one was amazing, given, let's put a little history on this. The last quarter, NVIDIA reported the stock just exploded to the upside. The results were so strong. The forward estimates as to what they were going to do, you know, were way ahead of what the analysts on the street had been expecting. So in some respects, I think the market was thinking, could that happen twice? You know, does lightning strike in the same place twice or whatever. Anyway, the report came out after the close of the floor session on Wednesday this week, and it was a reprise. I mean, it was, again, outrageously stronger than what the street had expected, and the stock just gapped higher in what we would call overnight trading. I think, you know, the usual. We added tens and tens of billions of dollars worth of market cap in a heartbeat. Then what actually, and that pulled the rest of the market up with it, particularly the NASDAQ. Then, of course, the irony is that by Friday afternoon, I guess, all of those gains, at least in NVIDIA, were gone. The market had fallen back again. And so we have a classic case, perhaps, of what we used to call buy the rumor, sell the news. So, you know, the rumor being that this report could be good, and then once the price reacted to that, you know, take your profits and say, thanks very much, I'm going away. Anyway, the adults, if they had been in the room, might have done the same thing. Who knows? Now, then the other item you mentioned, Jackson Hole on Friday. Again, the history on this, a year ago at Jackson Hole, and you know, got to picture this. This is kind of a Western retreat where everybody dresses up in cowboy boots and blue jeans and checkered shirts and stuff like that. And there's central bankers from around the world that are attending, and they all kind of, you know, get together and talk about what they're doing and what you should be doing and this and that. Last year, Powell kind of surprised the market, being a little more hawkish than either the market thought he was going to be or what they were hoping he was going to be. So was he going to do that again this year? This year, I thought he did something I've been writing about in my blog for over a year, and that is Powell keeps being more hawkish than the market wishes he was. You know, I think how I've explained it is, I think the market is kind of expecting that one of these days the Fed's going to stop raising rates. And when that happens, baby, you know, you just buy everything that's not nailed down. Well, you know, and my comment on that is Powell just, you know, he's made it plain. He keeps saying we are not going to cut rates this year or like anytime soon. And, you know, there's a lot more work to be done and so on and so on, that kind of language. Anyway, Powell spoke, I think probably he was pretty middle of the road, but certainly, you know, didn't say, okay, here's the key to the kingdom. And markets sold off, rallied back again, and we've what can I say, we're I think on the S&P we're down about 5% from where we were in the middle of the month. Anyway, the adults will be back another 2 weeks, but next week I think we should have another week of choppy price action.
In your notes last week, you also wrote about a key turn date in mid-July. You reported that interest rates, the U.S. dollar, have risen since mid-July while the stock market and gold have declined. Why do you think there's a strong correlation between these markets?
Well, I pay a lot of attention to correlation all over the place. I primarily use it for risk control. In other words, let's say I'm long the U.S. dollar and I'm thinking of adding a position where I'm going to be short gold. Well, that is actually, in many ways, just increasing the size of a bet that I've already got on. And I'm always concerned whether or not, with how much risk I'm taking in aggregate across my account. The correlation here, I think the driver is interest rates. In the middle of July, interest rates had backed off a little bit. That is like across the curve from short rates all the way to long rates. But since the middle of July, we've had another leg higher in interest rates. And the leg has been in this way, short rates haven't increased as much as long rates in terms of the impact that they had on prices. So I think roughly the reason for that is that the market's kind of coming around to the thought that inflation and interest rates will stay higher for longer. There's certainly the thought of, on the bond side, that there's going to be like fiscal stimulus forever. You know, particularly we're going into a federal election next year in the United States, but there's elections here, there, and everywhere. And I think governments have kind of come around to realizing, if they haven't sort of dangled the bait out there intentionally, that the public, voters, like fiscal stimulus. And so I think we're going to have more and more of it, which means there will be an increasing supply of bonds come to the market. And like in any market, if there's a lot more supply, usually, you know, prices respond. And in this case, you know, yields go higher, prices go lower with the bonds. So the move up in American interest rates, I think, has been a key to supporting the U.S. dollar against other currencies. And when interest rates and the U.S. dollar are both going up, that's generally a toxic environment for gold. So just to put that into perspective here, since the middle of July, that's about 6 weeks ago, we've had the U.S. dollar rise for six consecutive weeks. The euro's fallen for six consecutive weeks, as has the Canadian dollar and the Swiss franc and a couple of other currencies. And some of the other major currencies have fallen for, you know, five of the last 6 weeks. So it's been a pretty convincing run, probably on the short term a little overdone, and maybe we were due for a correction. But now, with the stock market, it was maybe coincidental or maybe not, or maybe a correlation. In the middle of July, we had that, what I call a defining moment with Microsoft reporting that they were going to bill their customers for some of the usage of artificial intelligence. When that report came out, it added $100 billion to the market cap of Microsoft stock within an hour. And I looked at that and I thought, my gosh, that is like what I call the cherry on top here, that we've had a terrific run from either, you know, you call it last October's lows or the lows in March. We had a terrific run in the stock market, particularly led by high tech stocks and, you know, the NASDAQ. And maybe this is the cherry on top. Well, it turned out, at least short term, to be. NASDAQ has dropped maybe as much as 9% from the highs that were made in the middle of July. But I think there's also not only that the stock market got maybe overdone in the middle of July to the upside, but rising interest rates, you know, inevitably are going to be a drag on the stock market. So that's sort of the correlation between interest rates, currencies, and the stock market.
Maybe the trading robots really like the AI story, and they traded it higher. Maybe?
Well, you know, I refer to them as machines. I mean, there's so much machinery or artificial intelligence or whatever, you know, that is trading the market in within, you know, nanoseconds. And, you know, a lot of the machinery feeds on itself, too. So But don't get me started on that. I'm just, yeah. I'm an old school guy. I like to think things.
And AI's been around for about 10 years. It's just people are talking about it now. Now, on your blog and previous This Week in Money podcast, you maintain that inflation and interest rates will be higher for longer. What are your reasons for saying that?
Well, I think, again, depending on your time frame, I think we went through the better part of a 20-year deflationary period from roughly 2000 to 2020. I think maybe the key turning point was during the COVID era when governments decided that they needed, you know, they wanted everybody to stay home, or they had lockdowns in one kind or another. And instead of seeing the economy just fall off the cliff, governments just did direct deposits into people's bank accounts, fiscal stimulus, and many other stimulative measures. And that was a bit of a passing the baton, I think, from the monetary authorities to the fiscal authorities for stimulating or trying to rein in the economy. And I think the governments liked what they saw. Certainly, you know, the people seem to like it, so the government wants to do what people want them to do, so that one thing follows the other. Now, once the inflation starts, then we get a thing I would call catching up, when your union sees that another union has gone out and got big pay increases with, you know, other benefits thrown in there, then your union's going to do the same. If you don't belong to a union, and let's maybe just stay with unions for a bit. I mean, we saw that certainly with UPS. You see reports of UPS drivers getting paid in excess of $150,000 a year. It seems like a hell of an increase. Now we've got coming up the United Auto Workers, and I've looked at the demands that the unions have, and I go, holy mackerel, that's pretty aggressive. Now, maybe that's your negotiating posture to start with, but without going down that rabbit hole too far, I'm just going to say that people realize that the purchasing power of their currency is going down, and they're going to do what they can to try to catch up. So they'll try to get paid more. That might mean quitting the job they have and going and taking another one. That might mean having their union represent them or to get higher pay, whatever. And it's not just the people, the workers, but the people that are running a business who've got higher input costs are going to do what they can to try to sustain their profitability. And we talk about shrinkflation. I mean, you can just go to the grocery store and see it. If the cereal box looks like it's the same size, you know, turn it sideways. You'll find that it's narrower. There's just less stuff in the same box, and the same thing with, you know, chocolate bars and whatnot. So we have this thing of trying to keep up with the Joneses, as my grandma might have called it. And I think once that develops momentum, you know, the economists call it a wage price spiral, and I think that makes a lot of sense. I think also, in an environment where we have debt, particularly at the government level, really rising, that there's some constituency that's going to say, you know, maybe 3% inflation is not so bad, or maybe 4%, and that helps us reduce the debt to GDP ratios and that sort of thing. Whatever, I think there's just a number of things that are going to have us in an environment where inflation will be more persistent and probably higher than what we've seen over the past 20 years when we were in more of a deflationary environment, you know, with globalization and demographics changing and all that. So I think a lot of things are changing now, and I think one of them will be inflation will be higher for longer.
You've been writing about the weakness in the Chinese currency as a sign of people voting with their feet. Does that mean money is leaving China? And if it is, why?
Yeah, no, I'm going to be a little careful with this one because, I mean, The Economist just put out a magazine cover with President Xi, or whatever his title is, riding a snail. And The Economist magazine is famous for sort of calling a bull market and it's a top or something like that, or a bear market and it's a bottom. I've got a few Economist magazine covers I've saved over the years that are like that, and not just the Economist magazine. But clearly there's been trouble in paradise if you're in China, and in a gross way of looking at it. I think we've seen a lot of leverage has been used in that market over the last 20 years, particularly in the real estate sector. And if the economy is going into a slowdown, or what do they call it, a recession with Chinese characteristics is the term I've heard, that is a nasty combination. And there's also been an apparent crackdown on let's say people that were getting rich. I mean, there was a leader some 25 years ago, something saying to the effect, you know, that to get rich is wonderful. And I'm sorry, I'm mangling the quote, but that doesn't seem to be the case anymore. If you're, you know, you don't want to stick out from the crowd, over there, you may get whacked down. So less business friendly. And then there's the trade wars between China and the rest of the world, call it, China is clearly slowing, and maybe some of the folks that were invested over there have decided that they would rather put their money someplace else. So yeah, there's been pressure on the Chinese currency, but this is in an environment, bear in mind, where the U.S. dollar has been going up against virtually everything, so also going up against all of the Asian currencies, from the Japanese yen, the Korean won, and the Chinese RMB. So, but I think it's more than just what's going on in the currency market. I think there is a sense of people want to get their money out of China.
Is the recent decline of about 5% in the S&P and gold a buying opportunity?
Well, isn't that the $64 question, or $64,000 question? I'll give you a fair answer, but I want to set the stage first. It truly does depend on your timing, and most of my timing with the trading that I do for my accounts is fairly short term. And by short term, I mean I'll take a position with the idea that I'm going to be in it for a couple of days or a couple of weeks, that sort of thing. I don't enter a market with the thought that I'm going to be in this position for the next 5 years, or as Warren Buffett says, you know, when he buys a stock, he expects to hold it forever. That's not me. So from a short-term time frame, I'd be sure. I could see a bounce, particularly, say, in the NASDAQ that's off 5%. I mean, it has been a fairly strong rally. I think I calculated that the S&P had risen about 20% from the lows in March when we had the Silicon Valley, you know, banking crisis that sort of blew over pretty quickly. But from those lows to the highs in the middle of July, it was up about 20%. So to say the S&P's backed up 5% doesn't seem like, you know, we're about to drop to zero between now and Christmas. So it could be just a little correction and carry on to the upside. I mean, there is a lot of momentum here, and I think buying or owning shares in a business could be seen as in some ways protection against inflation, particularly clearly if the stock market keeps going higher. But when I look at it from a longer term frame of mind, if I go back to, you know, let's say 2005 and look what the stock market has done since then, you know, the prices up here look to me, and that's just prices. We're not, and some of the internal things like their price earnings ratio and different things like that. I think the market seems pretty expensive, especially when you juxtaposition it with 5.5% yields in a riskless investment like a treasury bill. So, I could be a buyer of the stock market here, but I'd be buying it for the, you know, for 2 days to 2 weeks, and if it went against me, I'd be out of it pretty quick. And if it starts to show a little more weakness, I could be very comfortable to be back on the short side. For gold, you know, I did write, and I had a couple of comments on this a couple of weeks ago. I said, you know, buying gold here is like dancing with your grandmother. You know, I mean, there's just, when I look and see that people are just leaving the gold market because they find more interesting or more exciting things to do in other markets. Well, if you're a longer term gold investor, you go, oh, that's terrific. I can get gold at a better price. I mean, right now we're, gold prices are down about $125. That's about 6% from the highs that they had in mid-July. So, you know, if you're a longer-term investor in gold, then saving $125 probably that's good. Looks good to you. But if I'm looking at gold, I have to be thinking in terms of the strength of the U.S. dollar and where interest rates are at, and again, you know, my short-term time frame. Right now, I'm inclined to think that this we've had interest rates rise for six consecutive weeks and the U.S. dollar up for six consecutive weeks, probably due for a little bit of a correction in that. So, you know, the gold price might pop a little bit here. I don't have a position on gold one way or the other right now.
What are your thoughts on the U.S. and Canadian dollars?
Well, on this podcast, I guess, going back to January of 21, I remember being a buyer at that point, what I called blood in the streets with the people that invaded the Capitol building in the United States. It just seemed like that was a real low for America, for the world looking at America. And the U.S. dollar did rally from that point. We had a rally over the next year and a half to September of 2022, where the U.S. dollar got to a 20-year high and, you know, corrected substantially from there, about 15%. I keep saying that capital comes to America for safety and opportunity. It, you know, if not both of those things, then certainly one when it's the right time. If there's uncertainty in the world, and I think uncertainty is high and getting higher right now, that puts a bid in the U.S. dollar. And you get, you know, rewarded in terms of that is the place where, you know, they've got, the tech sector is just so much bigger, so much more vibrant, say, than anywhere else in the world, really. And I know some people would take me to task for that, and fair enough, but just, you know, generally speaking, there's an opportunity to invest in the tech sector like there isn't elsewhere in the world. I'm inclined to, on a longer term time frame, other than, you know, 2 days to 2 weeks, I just kind of remain bullish the U.S. dollar, probably more from the safety aspect than the opportunity aspect.
And
you said about the Canadian dollar. Canada has been a bit of a dog here since the middle of July, but it seems longer than that. If you're a Canadian and you're looking at Canada, you know, you might point to this or that political issue, or, you know, the housing market looks, you know, too high or all. But most of the valuation of the Canadian dollar, I think, happens outside of Canada. It's not, you know, something idiosyncratic to Canada. And as we've discussed before, you look at a long-term chart of commodities and the Canadian dollar, they're very similar in their ups and downs. Interest rate differentials are important. How the U.S. dollar is doing is really important. And then, you know, within the commodity sector, you know, how crude oil is doing. I've been trading the Canadian dollar very much from the short side for the past 2 months. And I'll say this with, I bought it on Friday at a, you know, it's been down for six consecutive weeks, and I may be out of that trade, you know, before next week gets started. But if it doesn't turn around, I just think it's very oversold right here in a short term, as I think, the U.S. dollar is very overbought. So on a short term basis, I'm long the Canadian.
The BRICS held their annual meeting. That's Brazil, right. Russia, India, China, South Africa, Saudi Arabia and the UAE, the United Arab Emirates, have now joined the BRICS. Iran possibly joining next year. Is this a sign that there's a world currency war versus the U.S. dollar? Because they've talked about creating their own currency.
Yeah. I mean, obviously, I see that. And I've seen different things like that for the past 50 years. And the U.S. dollar is still king dollar, and I don't think that's going to change. That's my short answer. I don't think those folks are going to be able to have a functional common currency. Are you kidding? I mean, look at the trouble that, say, France and Germany and Italy have in terms of having a common currency, let alone to have a currency between that group with a range of differences. So I don't see there being a functional common currency with that group, but you know, who knows? I'm wrong a lot.
The recent Tucker Carlson interview with Donald Trump on Twitter had about 250 million views. That's in a country of about 332 million. What do you think about that?
Well, I think there's a couple of people watched it a lot. what do I think about it? I mean, I think this week has been a very good week for Donald Trump. Including being indicted in Georgia for whatever they were getting him and the other folks for tampering in the election or something. I think probably what it means is, chances are he is going to be the Republicans' nominee to run for president in the election next November. He's certainly the front runner now, and it may be so far ahead of anybody else that's in contention that it seems like, unless something happens to him, you know, he's going to be the guy. And as much as there's a lot of people that don't like him for this reason or that reason, you know, one of the old sayings is that governments are voted out, not in, and there doesn't seem to be a lot of love for the Biden administration. So, what does it mean? I don't know. I noticed it. I saw that. You know, I watched the interview, the guy has got an amazing ability to draw attention to himself. That's for sure. But I think a lot of people just maybe see him as an opportunity for change in a whole lot of ways. So, you know, yeah, I think the best I could say is it looks that just seems to reinforce the idea that he's going to be the Republican nominee.
In your weekly trading desk notes, you usually have a section called On My Radar, where you talk about trades you might make in the future. Well, what's pinging on your radar screen right now?
Well, as I just said, I bought the Canadian dollar Friday going into the close. I thought it was overdone. I also bought the bond market. I think the bond market has had a very sharp sell-off here. And, you know, when I do these trades like this, I'll buy a market that's been falling, and I'll have a fairly tight stop. I would probably rather buy a market that's been falling, has bounced, and then back down a little bit, but makes a higher high. You know, I'll do that. But at the end of the week, I'm going into the weekend here, long of bonds, the 10-year note, and the Canadian dollar, because I think they're very oversold. But I could be out of that trade very quickly. I'll have a tight stop on it. But my approach here is, I think the market's due for a turnaround. So if I get knocked out of it, I'll probably look for a spot to put the trade right back on again. And I would call that probing. That's kind of my style. If I think a market's due for a turn, I don't figure I necessarily am going to get it right with the first position I put on. But if I am right, I think we could have a decent bounce, or at least a bounce that, you know, is worth my while in terms of the profits that I could make if I'm right on the trade. So that's what I'm doing. And I think the U.S. dollar has probably gone up too far too fast against all the currencies. So I could look for opportunities in other currency markets. But then again, I come to that thing about correlations, and If the Canadian dollar is going up, then, you know, the euro is probably going up in this environment, and so is the Swiss and the British. So I'm not getting any diversification. I'm just sort of doubling up a trade that I already have if I go out and buy those things. If the U.S. dollar is getting a bit of a lift, because I should say it is falling back because it's gone up too far too fast, that probably put a bid in the gold market as well, the silver market. And if interest rates are falling, then, you know, that's another reason to be looking at precious metals from a trading timing point of view. From a longer-term point of view, I think bond yields probably just keep going higher. In other words, the prices go lower. Somebody will buy the bond market, will buy the paper issued by the United States government, but it's going to be a question of price, and I think there's just going to be more and more and more of it, so the market will get swamped with supply to some degree. And then reasons to own bonds, other than they're maybe going to have a bounce, will be few and far between. So on a longer-term basis, I'd be looking to trade them from the short side. What else is on my radar? Right now, I'd say that's probably pretty key. And there's my dog barking. There's probably a bird flying or somebody at the door.
It's the dog days of summer, Victor.
Yeah.
Victor, thank you so much for being on This Week in Money.
Oh, Jim, it's always fun to talk with you. Thank you kindly for having me on.
My guest has been Victor Adair, recently retired from nearly 50 years of being in the brokerage business in BC, but still very active in the markets. His website, victoradair.ca. He was speaking to us from Parksville, British Columbia. Coming up, John Rubino, next on This Week in Money.
Recyclico, making lithium ion last forever. Recyclico's patented recycling process achieves up to 100% recovery of battery metals from lithium-ion batteries for electric vehicles, including cobalt, lithium, nickel, manganese, and aluminum. Recyclico Battery Materials Incorporated trades on the TSX Venture AMY, on the OTCQB AMYZF, and Frankfurt ID4. For more information, visit recyclico.com or phone us at 778-574-4444. Recyclico, making lithium ion last forever.
This Week in Money is archived online at talkdigitalnetwork.com.
Welcome back. My guest is John Rubino, author of several books on the economy, including The Money Bubble. He founded the website dollarcollapse.com. He's speaking to us from Washington State near Port Angeles. Welcome back to This Week in Money.
Hey, Jim.
John, the BRICS countries huddled up for a meeting this week. What came out of that?
Well, it turned out to be not what everybody was speculating about, but still it went out with a bang. Basically, what happened was they kind of trolled the West by about a month ago having some low-level Russian spokesman announce that at the BRICS meeting they were going to introduce a gold-backed BRICS currency. And, of course, all the talking heads in the finance space went wild with that. And there was speculation everywhere about how it was going to work. And at the actual meeting, no currency was introduced or anything. They talked a lot about de-dollarization, and about how maybe, you know, a few of them, like Lula from Brazil, said that it would be a good idea to have that kind of a currency, but they didn't introduce one. So that was a letdown. But on the final day of the meeting, they inducted Saudi Arabia into their group. So the Saudis are now members of an essentially anti-dollar trade and currency bloc. And they also inducted the United Arab Emirates, who are also big oil producers, and they announced that the following year Iran was coming in. So this is very big because it adds a lot of people, a lot of GDP, and a ton of natural resources to what the original members had. So suddenly, in terms of most numbers that matter, this is a significant organization, and they're not happy with the U.S. at all. They're tired of dollar hegemony. They're tired of the U.S. Blundering around the world and invading and bombing everybody in sight and using the dollar as a weapon against anybody who steps out of line. So they're moving towards basically dispensing with dollars for bilateral trade. They intend to use their own country's currencies right now. And some of them, like I said, are still keen on that eventual gold-backed currency that they all use for trade. So this is a big deal with long-term implications, and virtually all of those implications are negative for the developed countries and their fiat currency.
So that European colonization model that's probably run the world's economy for the last 180 years, that's going to be tipped on its head, right? Or they'll try to? Or they will?
You know, the BRICS guys are not saying that. They're basically saying they just want to be able to exist on their own and trade with each other, and they don't mean anybody else any harm or anything. But you know that the long-term implications of that are a huge power shift in the world, both in terms of economics and in terms of finance. So we'll see where it goes. You know, it's not going to be easy for these guys to cooperate because they're mostly dictatorships of one flavor or another. But they have a common enemy, which makes cooperation in their interest. So it's completely possible that that they get along for, you know, enough years to create something with some staying power. I don't know beyond that, though.
I was going to say only India and South Africa are democracies. All the rest are dictatorships. Well, Russia, is a democracy. Putin was, quote, elected. But we all know what happens to all the opposition members. They fall out of hospital windows
Russia's
and stuff.
It's a dictatorship.
Don't get into any private jets. You've been pointing out that many economic indicators are deteriorating. What are they, and how will they affect the overall economy?
Yeah, the headline numbers are still reasonably good, at least in the U.S. But under the surface, there's a lot of stuff going wrong right now. And among them are credit card debt is spiking. It just hit $1 trillion overall. And a growing number of people in the U.S. are having to put day-to-day expenses like food and rent and gasoline on their credit cards, which means they're carrying balances now that are charging them 20% plus a year in interest. That's loan shark level stuff there. And that's it's a slippery slope to bankruptcy when you start doing things like that. Meanwhile, the index of leading economic indicators, which is a big compendium of things that have impacts down the road, like, for instance, hours worked, that tells you what worker incomes are going to be in the next few months. And there's a bunch of other things like that. They put them all together into the index of leading economic indicators, and it's been dropping month after month for like the last 7 months, and it's still dropping. Meanwhile, commercial real estate is a mess. Interest rates are spiking. The average mortgage rate in the U.S. right now for a 30-year fixed rate is 7.3% or something like that versus 2.5% 3 years ago. So those things, along with a shrinking money supply and some internal labor market stuff that's not so pretty anymore, all point towards a slowing economy and maybe a recession in the not too distant future. So don't believe those headline numbers. And and one other thing that's scary, that is still kind of internal, but is liable to be headline news pretty soon, is that wage inflation is picking up. The two major airlines in the U.S. just gave their pilots 40% raises spread out over 4 years. So it's 10% a year in wage increases for those guys. And pilots are a special case because they have a lot of bargaining power. But a lot of other sectors of the economy have people who just aren't interested in coming back to work in an office building or in changing jobs at all. Companies are having to pay way up to get those people. So wage inflation might be embedded in the economy in ways we don't yet understand. And the Fed is afraid of wage inflation. So it could be that forces the Fed to raise interest rates beyond what they would anyhow, mm-hmm. which exacerbates all the other things I started talking about before, you know, credit card debt, housing problems, et cetera, et cetera, and gives us a really nice crash out there in 2024. So we'll see. But overall, be aware of these things happening and expect at least a slowdown and possibly something much worse in the year ahead.
Yeah, you posted an article this week on the possible downside of rising wages. Could you expand on that?
Well, yeah, that's basically something that is a good thing, right? When people are making more money, especially after three decades of corporations claiming the biggest part of corporate profits rather than workers, we've had this huge gap build up. It was already pretty big, but it's been getting much, much bigger in income between the people who own big companies and the people who work for big companies. That is a recipe for civil unrest on French Revolution level. You know, you get people in the streets and serious violence when financial or when wealth and income inequalities reach a certain point, and we're heading for that point. So it's a good thing that people are finally getting some of it back that's been stolen from them, but wage inflation is dangerous from the point of view of central banks. So if we have a good year for workers, but that leads to a spike in interest rates, which leads to a crash in the financial markets, then it really wasn't a good thing after all. So this is one of those things where be careful what you wish for, because there are unintended consequences that come along. And, you know, I hate to say that because I love the idea of everybody getting some nice big raises finally, but I'm worried about the implications. So again, pay attention to this. If wages are starting to make the headlines as being double digits plus, then we're running some big risks of a crisis that flows from that.
Yeah, and if you want to hear more about being replaced by a robot, San Francisco has just legalized robo-taxi, driverless taxis. And a friend of the show, Wolf Richter, in the interview I just did with him, said 70,000 to 80,000 people in San Francisco drive for Uber. Well, they're going to be out of work. And he said delivery drivers, they're next. And long-distance trucking, we know that robot trucks are legal in Nevada. And they're running test fleets of those where there's 10 robot trucks with one trucker following behind to repair anything that goes wrong. So if you're in the delivery or trucking or taxi business, your job right now is on the line. Does this mean we'll have to tax each robot to help support the worker who's been replaced by it?
Well, it's an interesting place we're at right now because you've got basically two groups of economists out there. One group is looking at falling birth rates. Yeah. And they're worried that there won't be enough workers in the future to support all the retirees. Another group of economists is looking at what you're talking about, how so many things are being automated that were not automatable in the past. And that's going to throw so many people out of work that we're going to have mass unemployment. Well, both of those things can't happen together, right? So they're mutually exclusive. So we'll have to see which of those trends is more powerful, but the automation thing is shocking. And it's not ending at driverless cars and things like that, because the new generation of AI can do all kinds of stuff that human beings used to have to do. You know, you can make gorgeous images of people that are very realistic with AI right now. They're super photogenic. You can replace them essentially for free with AI. So there's a whole category of people that you never would have thought would be out of work because of automation, but they will be. And there's all kinds of writing-related things and legal-related things, like paralegals are in danger now because AIs can write very creditable contracts, which is a big part of what paralegals do. And they can look things up. You tell them, you know, look up precedents for this set of circumstances. And an AI can go look those up and give you a nice list of things that apply to your case. So all kinds of things like that are happening out there, and it's happening really quickly.
Yeah, being replaced by AI, that's what the Hollywood writers and actors strike is all about.
Yes, Yeah, well, at least in part. Part of it is streaming, where you don't get residuals anymore if you're an actor and you're in a show. It used to be that you would get a check every time your show showed up on TV. Not true anymore when it's on Netflix or someplace, because the companies claim they can't track how often things are seen or anything, which they can, of course.
But of course
they don't
can.
Want to pay the actors for it. But yeah, AI, here's an interesting thing you can do with AI in the movie business. You bring an actor in. You take a shot of them moving around and sitting, and, you know, you get a really good body scan of them, and then you send them home. But you can replicate them using AI in every scene of the movie going forward. So they came in and they shot one scene, got paid for one scene, but they appear all over the movie unpaid. And that's a totally doable thing right now. That is a thing that is actually done right now for background actors. So it won't be long before it works its way further up the food chain to people who do slightly more complex too. So very interesting times coming. Yeah. And you're right. The upshoot or the takeaway from that is that we're going to have to find a way to tax the owners of AIs and of robots and spread that money around a little bit to all the people who are thrown out of work if it ends up being, unemployment because of that. So we could end up with some kind of a UBI, universal basic income system, just because AI throws so many people out of work and enriches a much smaller group of people in the process.
Well, already people are being spoofed. They can just copy your voice and then they'll use that to call relatives and friends claiming they need money, and people are already being scammed by AI generated voices.
Yep. So I'll tell you where the growth industry is going to be is in technology that allows you to recognize AI-generated content and separate it out from real stuff, which is another branch of AI, of course. So the people who currently do that will be replaced by algorithms at some point, but those will be really useful algorithms.
Is China entering a debt deflation loop? And if they are, what does that mean?
It's a very big deal. China generated growth not so much from exports and certainly not from any kind of import-related activity, but from investment. You know, they funneled money into cities and towns and pretty much everywhere else that they borrowed, or they had special purpose local organizations borrow, and they build airports and roads and entire new cities and factories everywhere now, and housing, of course. They have a massive real estate bubble. So now a lot of those things that they built are not creating sufficient cash flow to pay off the related debt. So you've got entities going bankrupt, defaulting on their debt, and then the people who had lent them money are defaulting, and so on. And you get into a feedback loop where one default leads to several other defaults, which leads to 100 defaults, and so on, until the whole system collapses. China's trying to deal with that, but the crappy level of quality in a lot of the stuff they built and the massive amounts of debt they took on to build those things are really debilitating, and they've got a big demographic problem. Their workforce is shrinking at the same time all this is happening, while their retiree base is soaring. So all they have left to do is liquefy. In other words, create a ton of new yuan, dump it out into the system, and hope that fixes things. And it's not clear that it can fix things like that. There's a limit to how big of a debt bubble you can blow up before it can't be peacefully deflated anymore. It has to burst, and China might be at that place. So that feeds back into the BRICS thing. What does that mean for the BRICS countries if China goes belly up financially? We don't know. No, nobody knows any of this stuff. The world is too complicated to know any of this. So own gold and stop paying attention. That's my advice to people. Just load up on precious metals, get some guns, and then detach from the world for 10 years and then come back and see what happened afterwards. I wish I could do that, but I have to write about it.
If China's in a deflation loop so far, you'd think that would be pretty bad for commodities. They've held up, for the most part, pretty well. Oil at $80, uranium near its recent high. Long-term contract prices are rising, but where do they go from here?
Well, if China is trying to reflate, that gives the commodities markets some hope, because over the past 10 or 15 years, the driving force behind commodity sales was Chinese industrialization. So everybody still hopes that maybe that'll happen again, and you just never know. But that's the big risk for commodities right now, that a big consumer of commodities like China has a financial crisis that leads them to cut way back on their buying. And you're right, though, a lot of commodities have held up pretty well so far. Oil just dropped below $80, but it's been at or above 80 for a while. Uranium is seeing some nice growth in the terms of long-term contracts. In other words, if you want to book your uranium to fuel your nuclear plant for years in advance instead of buying it on the stock market or on the spot market, you got to pay up. And what you have to pay is going up lately, which is good news for uranium miners. I'm less worried about uranium than anything else other than maybe gold and silver. Although gold and silver are at risk in the short run, but when everybody has to reflate in the face of a gigantic global debt crisis, gold and silver will just go through the roof. So you got to own them, even if they're at risk of a pretty big correction here in the near term. You just have to. So own a bunch of gold and silver. And then from that point in, when you're going up the risk spectrum, the really high-quality gold and silver miners have good stocks. Own them. The best quality uranium miners might actually make you money right through a crisis. And oil companies are just always good to own. So oil will fluctuate, but the best quality oil companies will still generate free cash flow and maybe will even still pay a dividend, you know? So own those. And you're probably okay. But do not expect a turbulence-free few years here. There's going to be volatility. And you need to be psychologically prepared for that, because basically anything can happen now. You know, I haven't even mentioned World War III, which we're on the verge of out there. So everything financial is contingent on no World War III. If we have a nuclear war, everything goes out the window. But barring that, there are financial things we can still do to protect ourselves.
Yeah. Wasn't it Einstein who said, I can't predict how World War III will be fought, but I will predict that World War IV will be fought with sticks and stones?
Yes. Yeah. World War III will be fought with nukes. World War IV will be fought with sticks and stones. That's unfortunately accurate. Yeah.
If there's anybody left to throw sticks and stones. The royalty streaming companies are down lately. Do you think they're still the best bets in the precious metal space?
Yeah, that's the best business model in precious metals. Basically, what royalty streaming companies do, and that's two different things, royalty and streaming. So it's royalty slash streaming. But they go to junior miners that are trying to get gold mines up and running and say, hey, we'll pay you $100 million to get your mine started if you promise to pay us 2% of whatever you dig out of the ground for the next 10 or 20 years or whatever. And in this kind of a market, when the junior miners are having trouble getting financing, the royalty slash streaming companies can cut very favorable deals where they're getting a lot of gold and silver relative to what they put into the mine process. And that's where these guys really shine. In times of correction in the junior mining sector, which we kind of are in now, it's a hard time to get financing for a lot of these little guys. The royalty streaming companies have no trouble borrowing money. So they just leverage up and then they go down and cut all these deals, which generate massive cash for them going forward. So right now they've got a lot of old deals, the biggest, best royalty and streaming companies have old deals that are generating lots of cash flow, and they have plenty of liquidity to go out and load up on future deals like that. And they don't really worry about any single mine getting into any kind of trouble. A lot of miners, one mine doesn't work out for whatever reason, and they're toast, or they're down by 50% or whatever, depending on how many other mines they have. But with a royalty and streaming company, One mine, not that big of a deal in the scheme of things. So they're insulated from the operating risk of the mining industry. They're insulated from the finance risk of the industry because they have such good borrowing power. So they tend to make tons of money when gold and silver prices go up. They have a lot of operating leverage. So they're just an excellent business model. You should own the top five royalty and streaming companies at all times. Just buy those things and just let them run. Don't even think about them after that.
Gold and silver are entering their seasonally strong period. Will that be a factor this time?
Maybe. See, what happens is there's usually other stuff going on during the year, and you look at those other things and think, oh, man, they will swamp seasonality for precious metals. And so you focus on those other things, and seasonality turns out to have an impact, and all you had to do was bet on seasonality. You didn't have to worry about any of that other stuff, and you would have made money. There's actually somebody who just emailed me the other day. There is some money managers who do that. They are a seasonal gold fund, where they just bet on gold seasonality. They buy it in July, August, September, when the Asian buying, in anticipation of Asians giving a lot of gold and silver jewelry to spring wedding participants, pushes the price up, and then they sell it in April or May when the summer doldrums hit and there's no buying. So where we are now is heading for September, which is usually one of the months where seasonality starts to ramp up, positive seasonality. And gold and silver had a good day yesterday, and I don't know what they're doing today. Let's see real quick here. I think gold is up a little bit last I looked. Yeah, gold is up slightly after a very good day yesterday. So it could be that we're already starting on the whole seasonal upswing thing, and we'll see where it goes. But there's no reason to think that this won't be another pretty good year. Because there's another thing that is backing the gold and silver price up is central bank buying. India is buying a lot of silver. China and Russia are buying a lot of gold. And a lot of other central banks have jumped into the gold market now, too. They had the biggest ever central bank gold buying in 2022. And then the first half of 2023 was the biggest first half of the year ever for central bank gold buying. So that is something that is not seasonal and is pretty continuous. So it's a wind at gold and silver's back, just as another wind, which is seasonality, comes in. So I think this could be a pretty good stretch here. Again, barring any really crazy stuff happening out there. There are lots of geopolitical, lots of financial blow-up kinds of things that could happen. But barring those things, seasonality looks like it should be a factor that helps gold and especially the mining stocks over the next 6 months.
John, anything else we should be keeping a close eye on right now?
Nah, there's so much going on, Jim, that we covered enough, I think, to keep anybody who's really paying attention busy. So maybe we stop here, and then next month we'll pick up all the other things that we should have talked about but didn't.
Yes, I, for one, welcome our robot overlords.
Me too.
John?
Jim, I don't think they'll ever replace you, though. Don't worry.
Oh, they're trying. John, thank you so much for being on This Week in Money.
Thanks, Jim. Talk to you soon.
My guest has been John Rubino, author of several books on the economy, including The Money Bubble. He founded the website dollarcollapse.com. And that wraps up our show for this week. We'd like to thank our guests, Ross Clark, Victor Adair, and John Rubino. And thank you for listening. If you have any questions for the show or for our guests, you can send them to info@howstreet.com. I'm Jim Goddard. We'll be back next week with more This Week in Money.
Comments made on This Week in Money are an expression of opinion only and should not be construed in any manner whatsoever as recommendations to buy or sell any financial instrument at any time. Archived online at talkdigitalnetwork.com. This Week in Money is a production of How Street Media Incorporated. Executive producer is Tom Allen.